The Tom Woods Show, episode 573.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, if you missed our webinar with entrepreneur and Ron Paul supporter Chris Record, we donated $2,000 to antiwar.com because we had so many people who were able to be there live. And when we polled people at the end, was this a good use of your time? Did you learn practical things? 96% said yes. Chris Record has business ideas coming out his ears, and he was giving us one after another during this webinar. It is not to be missed. Check out the replay at tomwoods.com/replay. Hello and welcome to another episode of the show. What a great topic we've got here. You probably think once in a while, how's Woods going to keep coming up with topics? I mean, it's episode 573. Eventually, you got to start repeating yourself or something, but doggone it, there are a lot of great topics out there, and I think overpopulation is a really good one. Because this was a really, really big issue, maybe a generation and a half, two generations ago, big, big deal, this warning about overpopulation. This is really how Paul Ehrlich made his reputation, as somebody who warned about overpopulation. He wrote The Population Bomb. And we did an episode on Paul Ehrlich and his famous bet with Julian Simon. And Simon won that bet. And that was a case clearly of a libertarian winning a bet with a statist. So you should check out that episode. I'll link to that on today's show notes page, which of course is tomwoods.com/573. So I thought we'd talk about overpopulation, but it turns out that the gentleman I invited to talk about this, who's actually written an awful lot about this subject, is also something of an expert on rather a different subject. So the person I'm talking about is Robert Zubrin, who is the author of Merchants of Despair, Radical Environmentalists, Criminal Pseudoscientists, and the Fatal Cult of Anti-Humanism. Of course, that will be linked on the show notes page. He holds a PhD in nuclear engineering from the University of Washington, many, many credentials. But interestingly, he is also the founder and president of the Mars Society, which is the world's leading space advocacy group dedicated to the human exploration of Mars. So how can I have Dr. Zubrin on and talk only about overpopulation? So toward the end, I will probably sneak in a Mars question. Probably that should be a whole episode. No one's going to be satisfied with the discussion of Mars in this particular episode. I primarily want to talk about overpopulation, but we'll talk about that a little bit as well. Stay tuned for some fun announcements after my conversation with Dr. Zubrin, whom I'm very glad to welcome to the show right now. Dr. Zubrin, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks a lot, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
I love talking to people who can speak intelligently about a zillion things because I know there'll be no dead air in the episode. A lot of stuff to talk about. In particular, I've never done an episode. Here we are at number 573 on the subject of overpopulation. And of course, this is a free market oriented show. The idea is that society can more or less arrange itself. And one of the criticisms of that is that if you leave people to their own devices, well, they're going to produce too darn many people. And this is going to put tremendous burden on the Earth's resources and on living standards. And the standard line here. How do you go about answering that? Because there is a superficial plausibility to that. You can understand why somebody would think that if there are too many people, we're just going to be too darn crowded, there won't be enough stuff to go around, and we're really going to regret having had so many people. Why is that the wrong way to think?
Well, it's wrong for a number of reasons. First of all, it's simply counterfactual. As the world's population has gone up, the standard of living has gone up, and significantly, and so that's simply a fact. Now, why has it turned out that way? In other words, if we go back, my book, Merchants of Despair, takes this discussion back 200 years to the seminal polemicist on this issue, which was Thomas Malthus, who in 1800 put forth exactly this argument. Here we are, so many hungry people in the world, and if the population increases, they'll all be starving all over the place because population is going to outrun production. And this turned out to be amazingly wrong. That is, when Malthus wrote his book in 1800, the average income per capita in the world was, in today's dollars, about $180 per year. Okay. Now, Today, the world has seven times as many people as there were when Malthus wrote. When he wrote, there was about 1 billion people. Now there's 7 billion. And the average income per person is about $9,000 or $10,000 per year in today's money. So the population has gone up 50 times, and the total product has gone up 350 times. So there's no one has ever been so spectacularly wrong. And this has been true at every step along the way. Back in 1968, there was a bestseller, The Population Bomb, written by Paul Ehrlich. Now, at that time, the world had, you know, about 3.5 billion people. And he said, by the year 2000, it's going to be 7 billion people. And there are hungry people today. They'll be starving in the streets in the year 2000, and not just in India but and China, but in the United States. And we need to have population control. But what happened? The average income per capita in 1968 was about $3,000. Now it's $9,000. So the population has doubled, and the per capita income has tripled, and the total product has multiplied six times. And, you know, the thing that was so spectacular about Ehrlich's mistake was that in his own lifetime, I mean, he wasn't just wrong about the future, he was wrong about the past. Ehrlich was born in 1931. When the population of the world was a little more than half of what it was in 1968. If his theory was correct, people should have been richer in 1931 than they were in 1968, which is exactly the opposite of the truth. So he was arguing against facts that he could have known from his own childhood. It's so wrong. So why, though, is it wrong? It's wrong because it isn't like there's population on one side and there's production on the other side, and you know, are the producers going to keep up with the population? No, it's the people who are doing the production. And the more people there are, the more producers there are. So every mouth comes with a pair of hands. But it's much better than that, because every mouth not only comes with a pair of hands, it also comes with a mind. And so the more people there are, the more inventors there are, and inventions are cumulative. So we are much better off today, not only because there is a global workforce of 7 billion people working for us with a global division of labor and a global market that spurs investment and production, we are better off today because of the larger number of people that existed previously. I mean, let's say Malthus had actually been listened to and his ideas enforced. So there have been half as many people in the world in the 1800s as there actually were. Well, okay, they would have used less coal, but we're not hurting for the coal they used. But if there were half as many people in the 1800s, there would have been half as many inventors. So you can give up either Thomas Edison or Louis Pasteur. Take your pick. Okay, which would you rather give up, electricity or the germ theory of disease? In other words, we are much richer today because there were more people in the 1800s rather than less. And where our standard of living depends upon all the innovations that they did. And similarly, if we were to reduce population today, we would impoverish the future, not enrich it.
What if you had somebody who's not necessarily a complete skeptic, but somebody who would concede everything you've just said and say, I agree that, of course, it would have been preposterous to do these things, and we have benefited from the larger population, but this trend can't go on forever. There are inherent limits to the extent to which population can increase while maintaining prosperity. Are there any such limits? And if there are there any ways that a free society can manage them?
I don't believe there are such limits. And I believe that the argument that there are limits is a polemic against a free society, and that is its purpose. I mean, look, fundamentally, and my book, The Merchants of Despair, goes through this. Okay, this argument has taken many forms, from Malthus, who said there wouldn't be enough food, to the Nazis, who said there isn't enough land to go around, to the population controllers, to the Club of Rome, who said there isn't enough natural resources to go around. And now today we have the global warmists, who say there might be enough natural resources, but there isn't enough right to use the natural resources, so we should leave. The problem is that we don't have enough coal and oil, it's that we have too much, and we must stop using it, despite the fact that we have it. It all takes the following form. There isn't enough of X to go around, therefore human aspirations must be constrained, and therefore someone must be empowered to do the constraining, and therefore tyranny is necessary. And this is precisely why this argument and the intellectuals who reformulate it constantly have never lacked for sponsors, because it's an argument for tyranny, and that is ultimately why it is sponsored.
All right, that's an important point, because even I sometimes, you'd think after doing hundreds and hundreds of episodes, I'd be a little bit more cynical about things, and I'm inclined to take things at their face value sometimes and not realize that the point of the program is the so-called unintended consequence. That's not some accidental afterthought. These people aren't stupid. They know what they're doing.
Yes.
You have an article, by the way. This is not directly related, but it's on the general subject of radical environmentalists, on the subject of green power, in particular green power in Germany. And your article has a headline indicating that this is very much going to hurt the poor in Germany. And what I want to raise with you is Paul Krugman, in a number of columns over the past several months, has been claiming that although in the past it was only hippies and, you know, crazy utopians who thought that wind and solar power would ever amount to a hill of beans, he says that the fact is their capacity and their cost per unit of energy, these things are getting much, much better for us. And so we should look to these sources as being realistic alternatives. Has there been any such trend as far as you can see?
No. The electricity and fuel prices in Germany have been quadrupled as a result of the insistence of its government of suppressing economic energy sources in favor of those that cost more. Furthermore, it must be said that Germany and Europe is being laid open to Russian domination by suppressing their own fracking. In other words, that Europe could be self-sufficient in natural gas and have much cheaper gas and electricity prices, but they have suppressed it, making themselves dependent upon high-priced, overpriced Russian exports. And so not only are they suppressing the standard of living of the European people and suppressing European economic growth, which is the cause of the global economic malaise today, but they are also facilitating the expansion of Kremlin tyranny into Europe.
I want to go back to population control for a minute. I shouldn't jump around, but so many things to talk about with you. I want to make sure I get to them all. With population control, it's obvious what the China policy is, and that was implemented with population control ideas in mind, and the idea of scarcity, and we need to limit the population. That's a really obvious case of where these ideas can go. But I bet most of this has been more subtle. And I would think, for example, of population control programs that maybe the U.S. government might be helping to support via international agencies around the world. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. Okay, before World War II, we had the eugenics movement, which was very strongly allied with Nazism, and which said that the population growth of the non-Nordic people had to be stopped because they're destroying the racial stock of the world, and there's only so much land in the world, and it should be reserved for the better people if we're to have a better world. Now, as a result of the fact that we went to war with the Nazis, this movement lost credibility in the United States. And in fact, the people who were sponsoring it had to quickly abandon it. However, after the war, within just a few years, the eugenicists came out again, but you could no longer talk about these goals in the same terms. It was no longer respectable to talk in these eugenicists Nazi-type terms. So instead, they simply said that the world has a population problem, and it's using up the world's resources and so forth. Now, this didn't have that much traction, but then they latched on to the Cold War. And, you know, during the Cold War, if you wanted to sell anything, you would say, we need to do this to stop communism. So they came up with the idea that they could sell this to the political elite by saying, well, you know, the population growth in the third world is going to provide the cannon fodder, the legions for the communist world revolution. And so U.S. foreign policy has got to be linked to population control. And in 1966, they managed to pass a rider to the Foreign Aid Act that would make foreign aid contingent upon the receptive countries implementing population control. The first victim was India. In 1967, there was a famine in India. Indira Gandhi came over here looking for help. Some people told Johnson, okay, we should make it that they help us in Vietnam. But instead, the population controller said, no, 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 we should make the condition that they impose population control. And so they did, and it was a brutal program. And then later on, this spread to numerous other third world countries. Now, these population control programs, okay, did anything but help the U.S. in the Cold War. They made us enemies among the people of the third world because they were being subject to this kind of oppression on the basis of U.S. sponsorship. But furthermore, these programs were not only racist in the large, they were racist in the small. That is, within each of the recipient countries, there generally is some ethnic group that has power and another that they despise. So naturally, the population control program within countries were always used by the dominant group to oppress the people they hate. So for instance, in India, it would be the high caste Brahmins doing population control on the untouchables. In Sri Lanka, it was the Sinhalese doing it to the Tamils. In Peru, the Hispanic people doing it to the indigenous Andean people, and so forth. And in Africa, tribe A, who's got the power, doing it to tribe B, who they've always hated. And this has been a massive global atrocity done with U.S. tax dollars. And the guy, and this is discussed at length in my book, Merchant Despair, how this worked. And people, Planned Parenthood and various other population control organizations have reaped billions of dollars of taxpayer money carrying out these programs in third world countries. Manufacturers of for instance, the Dalton Shield IUD, which was banned in the United States, they were able to sell it to the U.S. Foreign Aid Program to use in third world countries. So they were able to sell their junk abroad, paid for by U.S. tax money, to stuff that is not even legal to use in the United States because of the damage it does to women. I mean, it's incredible the things that have gone on here in our name and with our money.
Let me raise a again, I'm trying to think of devil's advocate sort of objections. Let's say we had an honest eugenicist, and let's say we had a eugenicist who didn't even care about race, who just said, I just want the best specimens of mankind. That's what I want. And the eugenicist may say to you, the problem with your theory about population is that it assumes that population will grow in such a way that we will get people who produce more than they consume. But our concern is that there's no reason to expect that, that maybe we will get population growth among – because it seems like the more intelligent, the wealthier have fewer children. We get people who maybe consume more than they produce, reproducing. Then that is going to put a crunch on resources. What would be the way to answer that?
Well, then it's counterfactual. I mean, look, the basic fact is this, is there are people who are constructive and people who are destructive. But on average, the average human being in the world over the course of history has created more than he or she has destroyed. And the proof of that is if the average person destroyed more than they created, we'd have nothing here at all right now. Okay, the fact that there has been a net product, that we've built cities and universities and civilization and art and science and medicine and all of this proves that the average person creates more than they destroy. And by the way, this is the crux of the matter, okay? Are human beings on average destroyers or creators? The anti-humanists argue that they are destroyers, and therefore the role of government should be to limit human numbers, activities, and liberty in order to preserve this pre-existing creation, which human beings as a virus are destroying. Whereas if you take the point of view that the human beings are fundamentally creators, then the essential role of government must be to protect liberty at all costs so that humans can be free to create as much as they can. And that is where this all comes down to. Whether you want liberty or whether you're looking for an excuse to suppress liberty.
Dr. Zubrin, I don't think it's possible to have you as a guest without also saying a little something about Mars, even though it's not directly related to this subject. I still feel compelled to ask you about it. I'm going to do that right after we pause for this message. Hey, everybody, this is a Tom Woods Show exclusive. I'm talking about something that is closed to the general public, but open just to you. And that is Zappable, the extraordinary smash-selling mobile app builder that you can use to create beautiful, wonderful, functional mobile apps for your own business, but also that you can sell to local businesses in your area. Because, of course, the chances that an app-building company has approached businesses in your area about designing mobile apps for them is pretty much zero. It's a very, very interesting and intriguing entrepreneurial opportunity, and Zappable is opening its doors again just for Tom Woods Show listeners with a special webinar this Thursday, January 21st, 2016 at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Watch how it works, get your questions answered, but get in on this, check it out, sign up at tomwoods.com/zap. Dr. Zubrin, along with links to your books and work on Mars, you founded something called the Mars Society, and you favor, well, what exactly is it that you favor? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Okay. Now, I've written a number of other books, but aside from Merchant of Despair, the one that I would like to bring to the attention of the listeners is my primary book on Mars, which is called The Case for Mars. And what that book outlines is how we can send humans to Mars in our time, not 30 years from now or 100 years from now, but within the next two-term presidential administration. And I think we should do it because we need to show the world what free men can do, and we need to open up a new planet to human civilization. Okay. But if you want to know how it fits with this previous discussion, let me read you a quote from Paul Ehrlich, who we have already discussed in this show, and his protege, John Holdren, who is currently President Obama's science advisor. And they wrote a book together in 1971 called Global Ecology. And they said the following, and I quote, "When a population of organisms grows in a finite environment, sooner or later it will encounter a resource limit. This phenomenon, described by ecologists as reaching the carrying capacity of the environment, applies to bacteria in a culture dish, to fruit flies in a jar of agar, and will apply to man on this finite planet." In other words, the ultimate arguments of the anti-humanists is that at the end of the day, we are confined to one planet, and so we're nothing but fruit flies in a jar of agar, and you know, and we need to have the wise scientists supervising this jar that we're in, limit our numbers so we can make the agar last as long as possible. And it's perfectly within their right to kill some of us so that the others can live a little bit longer. Okay, this is an outrageous position. And what is the ultimate refutation of it? I do not believe we're about to run out of resources on Earth anytime soon. But so long as we are confined to the Earth, this argument has the appearance of credibility. Okay, there's only so much to go around. Therefore, somebody has got to be crushed. Well, we open up space. We open up Mars as a new world. We're proving that human creativity has the capacity to open up a universe of resources to humankind. And in other words, we are completely blowing the top off of this anti-humanist argument. We're showing that everything we have comes from human creativity, that the ultimate resource is not land. In fact, land was not a resource until people invented agriculture. It's not oil. Oil was not a resource until people developed oil drilling and petroleum refining and automobiles and other kinds of engines that could use gasoline. It's not uranium. Uranium wasn't a resource until we developed nuclear power. Okay, the ultimate resource is human creativity, and this is what can open up the universe to us. The reason why we need to go to Mars is to show that there is no limits and that human beings can be free forever.
That's the almost the only argument that appeals to me, because if it's a case of, well, this is just something that, you know, scientists would like to try out, well, all right, but a lot of people have priorities and I don't see why those should trump everybody else's. But the most obvious objection, and I'm no doubt you've responded to it, is that as soon as you land on Mars, you realize that this planet is completely waging war with you at all times. You're not – there's a sense in which you are not intended to be there. in every way. I mean, dust storms are just a small part of the problem, and gravitation and bone loss and all these things that you hear about. But also, if I'm not in a suit and I'm not in a contained area, how am I gonna survive? It seems like the possibilities of death are so overwhelming that why would I want to try it?
Well, look, here's the thing. You know, in a very real sense, human beings are not native to the Earth. We're native to Kenya. That's our natural habitat. We are actually tropical animals. That's why we have these long, thin arms with no fur on them. But here I am. I'm talking to you from Colorado right now in the middle of winter, and no human being in the true state of nature could survive a single winter night here in Colorado. You had to develop technology for human beings to leave our natural habitat in the Kenyan Rift Valley and go global, go into Ice Age Europe and Asia and North America, because we developed technologies like fire and houses and clothing and big game hunting, which required weapons that could kill at a distance, and language to coordinate our activity so that we could actually take on mastodons and giant bison and so forth. And Nards, we have become a global species by conquering new environments through our technological creativity. And I would argue that the challenge posed to us of Mars is actually less than Ice Age Europe posed to early tropical man. And it is by using our ingenuity, by taking on new environments, that we have expanded our reach. And we have created a global civilization with vastly greater possibilities than ever could have been had we remained a bunch of tribes living in the Kenyan Rift Valley. And if we use our ingenuity again, we can become not just a global species, but an interplanetary and ultimately interstellar species with, you know, millions of civilized planets orbiting millions of civilized stars with all sorts of civilizations, language, dialects, great histories of heroism and contributions to technology and invention and new literatures and vast new possibilities as greater in concept and expanse to what we have today is what we have today was to what we had when we lived in Kenya. But you know what? I do think that that is the human future, provided we stay free. And if we do it, if we leave Earth, if we establish free human societies throughout this reach of the galaxy with all their magnificent technologies and civilizations that will exceed our own, you know, will seem as magical to us today as ours with our airliners and electricity and internet would be not only to the people of the Kenya Rift Valley, but even to the people of the Middle Ages 1,000 years ago. When those people look back at this time and look at what we did in launching this project, they will wonder at us.
Well, I'm going to direct people to tomwoods.com/573 because there they'll find the Mars Society, which is marssociety.org. But in case they forget that, it's at /573. We'll have the case for Mars. You have a, what is the title of your it's a playful title that I like about it's like a survival guide to Mars.
Oh, I have a sort of science humor book called How to Live on Mars. That's sort of a humorous take on the whole thing. It's a guide to immigrants to Mars from an old hand, and it's a mixture of science and satire and humor and okay. Science fiction. It's a fun book.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll direct people there too. And I mean, perhaps it's at some point this calls for a whole episode. But as I say, given your association with the Mars Society and all this work, I love talking about overpopulation, but it would seem it would be like, you know, having Shakespeare on to talk about you know, the weather and you know, not talk about his drama. So I felt I did need to at least get your basic overview of that question expressed. And I appreciate your opinions and your work, particularly this Merchants of Despair book, is very important. I just had a gentleman as a guest of the show who was formerly of Greenpeace, who's just completely turned around and said these people are all crazy and they're all anti-human. So I think it's important to expose this, especially because young kids in school are getting the impression that people who care about the environment are really just wonderful people who just want to make sure that everybody is well taken care of and that our resources are conserved. And no doubt there are such people.
Sure.
But they don't seem to be running these organizations.
No, they're not. In fact, Ehrlich's book, which called for population control, was published by the Sierra Club.
I didn't know that, actually. That's very interesting.
Yes.
You think of Sierra Club, you just think of wilderness, and it's harmless.
No. Look, here's the thing. Okay. In the 1970s, there was a cooling trend in climate. And the anti-humidists made much of this. They said, look, there's going to be a new ice age, and it's caused by pollution, caused by industry. It's caused by too much economic growth. It's out of control. It's got to be put under control. Put us in control. Then in the 80s, the climate shifted to a warming trend. They said, oh, there's global warming. It's being caused by industry and too much economic growth. It's out of control. It's got to be put under control. Put us in control. Okay. The problem is always different. The solution is always the same. And that's what people have to understand. Okay. This thing, it's global warming isn't about the weather. It's about liberty or tyranny.
Well, on that note, I will again say thanks. And I hope we can talk to you again in the future. And best of luck with your work. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, TomWoods.com/573 is the place to go for more information about the topics discussed in this episode. All right, announcements. Let's see. Here's a juicy one. This is a juicy one. You're going to love it. If you haven't been listening to Contra Krugman, I actually can't believe I'm starting a sentence with those words. But let's suppose theoretically that it's possible that you've not been listening to the Contra Krugman podcast. Well, then you won't know about this announcement. So this is for you. Bob Murphy and I, of course, co-host together the Contra Krugman podcast, and we refute Krugman's column every week at ContraKrugman.com. Well, Bob and I have decided to do a cruise. We're hosting the Contra Cruise October 9th through the 16th, 2016. We'll be sailing on Royal Caribbean, and we're going to have a great time. It's going to be karaoke and music and sessions of various kinds, and dinners, and receptions, and excursions, and games, and laughter, and many great memories. Now, come on now. You're telling me you don't want to go on that. You know, people are salivating on the other end of this thing. I have to believe that, because it is impossible to imagine that this won't be an extremely enjoyable and memorable time. So, right now, what I want you to do is just save the dates. Because in the coming days, we will have a site up where you can find out all the details, where you can sign up. It's going to be fantastic. So that's the Contra Cruise. That is the first of my announcements. The second of my announcements, I guess I don't know if it's really an announcement, but I'm urging you to check out a free book. I talked about it in the bonus episode just the other day. Yaro Starak, who's a great entrepreneur who's had tremendous success as a blogger in terms of actually being able to do it for a living, shares what he's figured out about how that works. It's not that you try to get a million people coming to your blog so that you hope that they click on some ads so you can make $10. That's a really bad strategy, but that's what most people think they're supposed to do. No. Don't even think about that. No. You should read Yaro's book, which I myself have read. It's actually much more attractive looking than most of the ebooks I've produced. Sorry to report from my end of things, but it's a great book, and it'll give you a lot of useful ideas, and you can get it for nothing. So it's called Blog Profits Blueprint. It's written by Yaro Starak, and you can get it at TomWoods.com/Yaro. That's Y-A-R-O, TomWoods.com/Yaro. Now, tomorrow, Paul Gottfried comes back to the show, and what we're going to do is look at a column by Jonah Goldberg. I'm sure that name is familiar to many of you out there. Jonah Goldberg wrote a column basically saying, look, we got to retire the term neoconservative because whatever purpose it may have served in the past, that's long since gone. It serves no useful purpose any longer. And really, maybe there aren't any neoconservatives, or if there are, well, pretty much everybody's a neoconservative now. Everybody agrees with the neoconservative position in the conservative movement. So how can it be useful to use this term? Oh, my goodness. Are Paul Gottfried and I going to have fun with that topic? So I hope you'll join me for that episode, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.